carryover. So let's go ahead, and I'm going to open House Committee on Revenue as a subcommittee of the committee. And let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We'll go ahead and open then as a committee of the Committee on House Committee on Revenue. How's that? For April 4th, it's 4 minutes after 1 o'clock, this morning, or this afternoon, we've got three bills that are up, and we're going to go ahead, we've got Representative Flores here, so we're going to go ahead and take those in order, beginning with 2951. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2951. Good afternoon, Representative Flores.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come to you today. For the record, my name is Linda Flores. I'm State Representative of House District 51. House Bill 2950 before you and under consideration is the reason that we're here today. And the reason for this specific bill is manyfold. First, as an appointed member of the Oregon Commission for Child Care, there are a couple of issues that have become important and apparent to me. Oregon is non-conforming with federal definition of unemployment wages in the area of dependent care, and that is the primary concern that this bill addresses. Proper care for children is just as important as retirement benefits or medical insurance. These employer-provided benefits are not included in the definition of unemployment wages. It is needlessly complex for employers to have to cope with this.
Representative Flores, let me do this. I am going to also open a public hearing on House Bill 2950 as well as 2951 so that you can mingle your testimony on both of those.
Thank you very much. Oregon needs to improve its dependent care situation. Enlisting the help of employers is one of the ways to get more dollars into this. We know what good child care looks like. We just don't know how to pay for it. Leaving the situation as it is a disincentive for employers to get involved. Internal Revenue Code Section 129 payments are excluded from all federal payroll taxes. It is anti-business for Oregon to include them. And, Mr. Chair, I do believe you have written testimony from Lynn Anglin, who is a CPA with a master's degree in taxation. It would look like this. And if you would like, I will read it into the record to give her rationale and support of this bill as well. In Lynn Anglin's voice, I would say, I am an Oregon voter, a certified public accountant with a master's degree in taxation, an employer, parent, and former owner of a child care center. I have the education and experience to comment on this bill. This bill should become law. It conforms the Oregon definition of employment wages with the federal definition as it relates to Internal Revenue Code Section 129 plans. These are plans whereby employers pay dependent care costs for their employees. Currently, Oregon taxes such payments as wages for Oregon unemployment tax, although the federal government does not. Oregon does not consider medical insurance or retirement plan contributions made by employers for their employees as taxable wages for unemployment purposes. Why should dependent care payments be subjected to this tax, she asked. Additionally, Oregon compounds this problem for employers by its published instructions in Form 132, the form on which Oregon unemployment tax is figured. These instructions state, quote, generally, wages reportable for Federal Unemployment Tax Act purposes are reportable for Oregon unemployment insurance tax, close quote. This leads unsuspecting employers to exclude such payments from Oregon unemployment wages since they are clearly exempt from FUTA. In practice, however, Oregon audits and assesses tax, penalty, and interest on employers who, following these form instructions, fail to pay Oregon unemployment tax on these payments. Ms. Anglin can find nowhere in any state publication where it is disclosed that these payments are subject to Oregon unemployment tax. One must read the actual Oregon administrative rule and interpret it, as does the taxing authority, to get it right. Oregon has an interest in the availability of quality dependent care for its children. The state is expending funds in a focused effort to enlist the participation of employers in providing and funding of quality dependent care. This is an excellent idea. Section 129 plans offer a cost-effective way to get more dollars into dependent care in this state. It makes no sense to Ms. Anglin that concurrent with this effort, Oregon continue with this hidden tax trap for employers who do try to help. This doesn't cost the state a lot of money. It might well cost less than correcting all the misleading Oregon publications. It is in the best interest of Oregon's children to conform to the federal laws and exclude Section 129 plans from the definition of unemployment wages. House Bill 2950 does just that. And, Mr. Chair, if you would like me then to move to House Bill 2951.
That would be fine. We've opened the public on both of those representatives, so if you would do that.
Thank you very much. Once again, as a member of the Oregon Commission for Child Care, it was brought to my attention the need to address an upcoming sunset. House Bill 2551.
2951.
2951. Thank you very much. Addresses the removal of a sunset provision for child care providers. And I will just go follow up by saying child care providers in certain businesses are among the lower paid Oregon workers, but parents continue to have a difficult time affording that care. We currently have a credit for businesses that provide child care subsidies to their employees. This credit is scheduled to sunset in 2006. The tax credit offers tax advantages to both the employee and the employer, but the ones who truly benefit from the tax credit are the children. Because the tax credit is due to sunset in 2006, there may be many businesses that are not willing to invest in the program. The dependent care tax credit enables Oregon businesses to receive a credit against state taxes for providing family-friendly benefits to their employees, which includes child care. Major employees rely on the credit to recruit and retain their workforce. Eliminating the sunset would allow businesses to invest in child care programs and facilities. It benefits providers who take advantage of the credit by allowing them to provide free or low-cost child care to employees. Let's continue to make child care affordable. When this bill passes, more employers will be willing to get involved. And I do believe also, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that you have a packet of testimony from various individuals. Again, a letter from Lynn Anglin, the CPA with the Master's in Taxation, owners of Learning Tree facilities who specifically had talked to me about this bill as well, and then a couple of other individuals. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my testimony and be willing to answer any questions.
Questions of Representative Flores on House Bill 2951 or 2950. Thank you very much, Representative Flores. You've honored us by coming today and taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I do hope that these will meet with your favorable consideration.
Thanks again. Let's see, Tina Kotek, you're signed up on both of these, on 2951 and 2950. If you'd like to come forward, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm the Policy Director with Children First for Oregon, but I'm here before you today on behalf of the One Voice for Child Care Coalition, and I'm submitting testimony on behalf of the coalition. Chair Butler, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify today in support of both 2950 and 2951. The One Voice for Child Care Coalition, and many of you, I think, received a visit from the coalition last month, talking about how we can improve child care in the state of Oregon. The coalition is comprised of statewide organizations, advocates, parents, and child care providers who understand that we need a stronger child care system in the state to support our economy as well as to support our working families. We have prioritized the dependent care assistance tax credit. This session is one of our six priorities because we believe we need to incentivize private investment in the child care system. 2951 would eliminate the sunset on the tax credit, and then 2950 is a housekeeping bill to make it easier for employers to understand how that would work for their unemployment tax purposes. We hope you support both the bills and be happy to take any questions that I could possibly answer about the tax credits.
Tina, the staff summary and write-up indicates that there's, in 2002, 24 corporations claiming the dependent tax credit for total tax credit claimed of $2.3 million. 58% of those corporations claimed the tax credit had reduced their tax liability. Total amount of dependent care tax liability was $996,570, or 43% of the total tax claim. The average tax credit was $71,184.02. These aren't small companies. These are fairly substantial companies. Can you give me a kind of an example of the companies you're looking at? It appears that these are fairly substantial companies that are offering these kinds of benefits to their employers who have children.
Chair Butler, that's an excellent question. Unfortunately, I don't have all the details on those employers. I can get them for you. My understanding, there's a range of employers who take advantage of that credit, anywhere from small businesses. For example, I believe Lynn Eglund, who submitted testimony, is a tax preparer in Prineville, I believe. She has an on-site facility. She takes advantage of the credit. I think she has around 10 employees or maybe thereabouts. And then you have larger corporations who use it. That might be a question for the Employment Department or for Revenue to give you some background on that.
But it appears, I guess, when I look at it and see 24 corporations taking total credit of $2.3 million, even though they can't use it in the current year, some of these must be pretty hefty child care programs. Can you at least give me an example of what one of those looks like? I need something to compare it to in my own mind's eye because don't have many of these in Vail, Oregon or Jennifer.
Sure. Sure. Chair Butler, I know a representative from Nike's here, so they might be able to explain how they might take advantage of that credit. In terms of other programs, there's a range because, as you can see from the credit, it could be for an on-site facility, it could be for resource and referral services, or vouchers in the community for a child care provider. It really depends on the employer. I do think those are really good questions, and given the last-minute notice for the bill, I'm not prepared to answer all those, but we could get you more information around what that's used for. But we know, bottom line is, if we'd like to see more employers taking advantage of the credit, often we hear that some employers, because of other credits, don't have a lot of tax liability, so they don't use it. But the ones who do think it's really important, they're committed to providing child care for their employees. And if we're going to grow the system in Oregon, we have to have those carrots out there to encourage a little more private investment because it's really good for the employers as well as the parents, because employees will be better in the workplace if they know their child is in safe quality care.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions for Tina? Other members of the committee?
Chairman Butler.
Yes, Representative Comp is recognized.
Tina, the question I have is more towards the end product that you're saying is that the work person is more efficient. I guess, do you have data are they working a full day? Do they get time to go down and see their infant at a certain time? I mean, what are those benefits that make them more efficient? I would want, if you're getting information, I'd like to see some of those things kind of identified.
Chair Butler, Representative Comp, that's also a very good question. I can get you some information. The research I've seen is more broad than that employees, when polled, there's higher workplace morale, less absenteeism because, you know, their child's in a place that they know will be there, you know, a safe place for the entire day, and there's not, stability in the child care provider. But I know there's some national research on that, so I can get you some of that.
Just follow up.
Yes, and Representative Julia Brim Edwards is here from Nike, and
okay.
I think they have a rather substantial program.
Okay, because my thought is, the most basic one is, are they on the job more days when they have, are they missing less days of work?
You bet.
I mean, that's
great,
just
great,
hopefully one of the better benefits that they're there.
That's my understanding, so we'll get you that data.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Representative. Thank you, Tina. Let's have Julia come up, if you would, please. Julia Brim Edwards with Nike. And I I do recall my one trip out to representing the Cassie District, having driven by Nike and seen their program, a children's kind of a program right there next to the campus.
So hopefully I can answer all your questions. Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Julia Brim Edwards, Nike's Deputy Director for State and Public Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee about House Bill 2951. I should note that I'm also here today speaking to you as a parent of three young children and as a former commissioner on the Oregon Commission for Child Care. And from my service on the Child Care Commission and as a parent of three kids, I know firsthand that finding high-quality child care is a significant issue for working parents and that any assistance that employers can provide to parents is a valuable benefit. As you probably know, Nike is a homegrown Oregon business that directly employs about 6,100 employees at our campus in Beaverton. And many of our employees are young parents with young children. So access to high-quality, affordable child care is an important employment-related issue for them. Nike supports the extension of the Dependent Care Assistant Tax Credit. This credit provides incentive or supports to Oregon businesses that assist their employees with child care costs. Nike, as was referenced earlier, has a center on our campus. It's the Joe Paterno Child Development Center. It serves about 210 children and is currently the largest licensed facility in the state of Oregon. And in January of 2002, the center was granted accreditation by the National Association of Education for Young Children, and that's an accreditation that only about 7% of early childhood programs nationwide have earned. If you visited the campus on a work day, and I invite all the members of the committee, if you'd like to come up and see our facilities, we'd be happy to give you a tour and show you the facility, both the inside of the facility, but also the outside playgrounds that we have for the children that are there at the facility. But if you came on campus, you would find groups of Paterno children playing basketball, of course, Nike, riding trikes, swinging, swimming, and playing the sand. And you'd also see at various times during the day infants and toddlers with Paterno staff out on the campus for walks. The high-quality on-site child care offered by Nike to its employee is an important benefit to our parents and their children. As was the question that came up earlier, is what's the benefit? If you were, in some ways, I'm a little bit envious that my kids now are all school-age because I can't partake in this benefit. Certainly, when I had much younger children, to me, I could see the benefit is quite apparent. You can drop off your child there at work throughout the workday if you wanted to visit your child, either go read, have lunch, feed your child, whatever that you wanted to do, you're welcome to drop into the center. It's right there on campus. And that as a parent, I know that knowing that your child's in good hands and safe during the day does improve a parent's focus and productivity. I think as parents, frequently when you get that call in the middle of the day from the child care provider, it is an employment, becomes an employment-related issue. Although the Paterno Center is the largest in Oregon, it currently has a wait list of several hundred parents and families. We're actively, in fact, evaluating some options to build another additional building on our facility once annexation issues related to the city of Beaverton have been resolved. From Nike's standpoint, extending the credit, as this bill would do, recognizes that child care is an important employment issue for families and that this is one tool the state has to support employers who assist their employees with child care issues. A credit extension at this time, as it was referenced earlier, the extension date, will allow businesses that use the credit to proceed with future business and employee benefit planning. So I appreciate the committee's considering this bill. It's an important employment issue for Nike and also clearly for the parents that currently use the Paterno Center on our campus. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Julia. The average age, or well, the age of the high and low age of the children at the Paterno Center?
It's all preschool age, so infant up to 5 years old, but the year before they go to school.
Okay.
There used to be a sort of kindergarten age component, but now it's focused in the sort of 0 to 5.
So it's really infant on up then?
Mm-hmm. Infant, preschool, and toddler.
Questions of Ms. Brim Edwards? Yes, Representative Kahn.
Just one clarifying. It's kind of what I use as a measuring guide for daycare centers. Do they have a facility, a room for nursing mothers so that they can do that in comfort and private, not have to do it in the restroom?
Yes. And if you, again, if you'd like to come see the facility, we'd love to have you look at it. It's something I think that we're quite proud of as an employer, something that we offer to our employees.
Well, I'm just glad to see it being moved out of restrooms.
Me too.
Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I one small question. What would you say is the benefit to employers of having child care centers on site?
Well, I think if you look at a band of sort of an age band of employees, certainly people are committed and devoted to their jobs, but also there's nothing like the concern about your child to maybe distract you from your work. And so one of the things to having a on-site child care facility is that you're able to, if you wanted to go over and check on your child or have a conversation with the child care provider, you're able to do that, and it gives you peace of mind. As I say, I've got three kids who have all been in a variety of different settings, and it's a huge issue for people who have children in that preschool age band.
Right.
Follow up, Representative Riley.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good benefit for the employees. Employers are concerned about dollars. Is there any study? Are there any studies that show dollar benefits to employers for child care centers?
I mean, what the sort of indirect benefit would be? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know, if, not to put somebody on the spot, but someone from the Oregon Commission for Child Care might have sort of that broader impact. I mean, certainly we see an intangible benefit at Nike, but I don't have a study, but I'd be happy to try and facilitate getting you an answer.
I think the question he's trying to get at is a productivity issue, the amount of productivity from parents that have to find a spot for their children and have a three to five person child care program, and then have somebody not able to run that program 1 week and then start it back up the next. Those are the kinds of benefits. And I think probably we could say intuitively we know that there's a rather significant benefit to the employer, because the employers probably are doing cost ratio benefits of what are happening there.
That I know of, we haven't quantified it. I think the intuitive, that's, we could go and look to see whether I can check to see whether we've quantified it, but I don't think that we have. But I think the intuitive, we know that there's a direct benefit just from feedback from our employees, and again, the fact that we have several hundred families on the wait list to use our center.
Thank you. Julie, do you get some impression that particularly with regard to young mothers and those kinds of things, that Nike has a better track record of bringing those people who are in the childbearing years to the table in terms of bringing them to work where they have these children easily cared for? Is there any information relative to the age of your employees and those demographics?
We have a young workforce, I think partly because of the nature of our company, and we're also a young company. I'll give you just an example that's somewhat personal, is that my sister, who was a former Nike employee, had a child who was in the Paterno Center. It was a factor that allowed her to continue working at the same time knowing that her child had very high quality care, just in terms of the ratio and the accreditation and the experience of the staff.
Brought her back to work with her.
Well, she was able to go back to work because one of a big barrier to young mothers going back to work is finding adequate child care. When I was on the Oregon Child Care Commission, a huge issue that we were wrestling with, and I know it's still an issue, is sort of the toughest piece child care to find is child care for infants because of the greater care needed, the lower ratios, just the economies of providing that type of care. So the fact that we provide infant care, I think, helps people return to work if they have taken a maternity leave or if they're thinking about working at Nike, that's something that you can take into consideration.
Is this anything that is mirrored in municipal or state service, such as at our university systems, at the K-12 systems? Is it done by the state of Oregon or any municipal organizations that you're aware of?
Well, that's a good question. I'm thinking back to when I actually was an employee of the state of Oregon working for the legislature when I had a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old, and the answer was, not that I knew of, you were on your own. So that I know of, I'm not aware of that, but maybe that's a question that the Oregon Child Care Commission representatives could answer.
Okay, and the final question in that regard, with regard to the paternal assistance program and the paternal child development center, is it an equal opportunity so that fathers that are working there can also drop off there?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And if you were there at 8:45 in the morning, it's a very interesting scene because as I walk into campus, I walk right by the child care center, and my guess is I would say there's more, just this is sort of not a scientific survey, but almost more dads dropping their kids off in the morning and picking them up in the afternoon. So I think there's no sort of gender barriers in terms of access to the facility.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Mr. Chair, in answer to your specific question, as far as the public sector, I can... As a younger woman with young children, I got myself deeply involved in some of these issues, served on a number of child care committees, and I can tell you that this is an ongoing issue, and it won't end soon, particularly with the cost of just living in today's world. Young families have to have child care because both parents have to work. In a real specific issue to which you just raised, Chemeketa Community College here in Salem has had a very fine child care system and literally a lab school for training people. And in the recent budget cuts, that has come under the axe and been quite controversial.
Is that for students? Or
it's for students and staff, and again, long waiting lists for families wanting to get in excellent child care. And infant care is hugely expensive. Caring for infants is expensive. And unless you make enough money to cover the costs, it becomes a double bind for young families.
Thank you. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Nike have, in other facilities, child care centers, and what's the tax code of either those states or those nations? Are you familiar?
That I know of, the answer is no. I'd want to check the other place where we have domestically a significant presence is in Tennessee, where we have a large warehouse distribution, and I could check that I know of. We do not, and I don't know what the state law of Tennessee is, but I'd be happy to get back to you.
Okay.
That would be good. Further questions of Ms. Grimm Edwards? Thank you, Julie. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Most kind for coming. And let's see. Also, with regard to 2950, Tamara Brinkman from the Department of Employment here is here and is going to reveal a disclosure on 2950 on behalf of the Employment Division.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And I am here to just say briefly that House Bill 2950 raised some concerns for some folks in our tax section within the Employment Department. And I subsequently reviewed the language of this bill with the language, pardon me, of the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. And I don't believe there is a problem with this bill in exempting that money from the money that is in that credit from unemployment insurance wages at the state. We just need to get our final word from the federal government, from the U.S. Department of Labor, to make sure that we'd be okay with that.
Okay.
Because I'm not the final authority.
And do we know, Tamara, what happens with other states that are participating?
I do not know that, Mr. Chair, but I'd be happy to see if I could find out. About the only way to find that out would be to check with the Department of Labor to see if they have kept a database on those states. So I will double check with that. And the other thing that I might add is I think that if, assuming that this bill is okay, which I think that it is, we might need to amend Employment Department statutes with respect to the definition of wages as well, because this is just amending the Department of Revenue statutes.
Okay, so this is relating to dependent care assistance and creating new provisions. Your thought is within this, potentially within this House bill, we could amend those Department of Employment provisions as well?
With respect to the definition of wages, I believe so, and I think it would be prudent to do so if, assuming we get positive word from the Department of Labor, which I don't have any reason to suspect we won't.
I've got a sneaking suspicion that Ms. Lincoln is a member of a multi-state commission where that information is readily shared and readily available. Perhaps she wouldn't have to make a trip all the way to the feds to find that out.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to check. She is. We are a member of the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, and so I would be happy also to pose the question to that association to see if they also have information about this.
If you would do that, please, Tamara, and then we'll bring this back.
Okay.
And if you'll communicate with the staff, we'll appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Other questions for Ms. Brinkman on behalf of the Employment Division? Thank you, Tamara. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Now, we don't have anyone else signed up on behalf of 2950 or 2951. Is there anyone here that has come specifically to testify on either of those two bills that has not had an opportunity to do so? With that, colleagues, Elizabeth, we did not give you an opportunity to open on either one of these. Do you have any sage wisdom and counsel with regard to the fiscal impact, particularly on 2951?
Chairman Butler, with 2951, this is just basically looking at some growth in the economy, and so this this tax credit is assumed to grow over time. And then, as we were talking before, there is some unclaimed unused tax credit with this in 2002. So given that information also, we're going to see some growth in that because it isn't beginning until January 1st, 2007 as far as the sunset going away. So that's why these revenue impacts are higher than what I reported there in the staff measure summary as far as what was actually claimed in 2002. But basically, in 2007-09 biennium, it would be a reduction of roughly $4 million, $3.96 million. And then by the 2009-11 biennium, $4.7 million as far as the reduction from extending that sunset. And again, this is not an extension to a different date. This is a complete elimination of the sunset, so everyone's clear on that. And the only other thing I would say about 2950 is I just think we need clarification from employment exactly what is current law as far as, we're getting two different stories here on 2950. So I think we needs to be clear exactly whether or not federal government allows these unemployment or these dependent care assistant payments to be made outside of wages, and then also whether or not, if we're going to disconnect from federal, if they do include it, then we need to have that clear exactly whether or not there's any implications to that on 2950, because I think there's still some uncertainty.
I'll take that as a personal challenge to go ahead and perhaps meet with Tamara as well, and yourself, Elizabeth. And then, thank you, Tamara. And then I'm going to ask Tina Kotek to also contact our office and on both of these bills with some additional questions that I have. Tina, if you can do that. Any other discussion? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a supporter of these bills because I'm a huge supporter of workplace child care. But I'm a little uncomfortable with completely eliminating any sunset on any credit, and I would like to maybe think about the possibility of extending it other than eliminating it.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Representative. In that regard, 2951 looks like it's been around since 1987, was enacted in 87. Was it originally for a 20-year? Or did we?
I think it's been extended since then, yeah.
All right. He'll give us the history on that, too.
Okay.
And then Representative Riley, your point is well taken. Mm-hmm. The only issue would be, could we conceivably look out into the future and see that these would be detrimental to society and detrimental to the overall tax system?
Can we do that with any of the credits that we think are good?
Well, I can sure think of a lot that I think are good, so I'd hesitate to have go away. But
yeah.
Okay, but your point is well taken. Thank you very much. If there's no further discussion regarding House Bills 2950 or 2951, we'll close the public hearing on those two House bills with an opportunity to bring them back at a later time after we've had an opportunity to work on and discuss them privately. And now I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3110. Colleagues, so we have the full committee here. I would just have you look at your calendars. We are scheduled for an extra hour on Wednesday.
Right.
There would be no meeting on Friday.
Right.
And then we're going to look at Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week through 4 o'clock. So we'll begin to try and lengthen our stride and quicken our pace. So with that, 3110.
Thank you. House Bill 3110 creates a new low-income rental assisted program for a qualified person whose household income is less than 100% of the federal poverty level and whose rent exceeds 30% of household income. And this rental program is for individuals that would be fit the qualifications and be under the age of 58, because we currently have a program in place already for individuals who are over 58 years old and meet qualifications for low income. The proposed program, however, would be administered by the Department of Revenue and will entitle the claimant to an amount not to exceed $1,500 that equals the positive difference between the claimant's gross annual rent and 30% of his household income. For just to update you on the 2005 federal guidelines for poverty, it's based on the number of persons in the household. For one person, a one-person household, that would be $9,500, roughly. For two, $12,800. For three, $16,000. It's higher in Alaska and Hawaii. The program will disqualify from rental assistance persons who are currently enrolled in Oregon's existing elderly rental program, persons who are currently receiving payments from the Department of Health and Human Services, unless the amounts received are less than the amounts that could be paid by the proposed rental subsidies, in which case the Department of Revenue would be allowed to pay the claimants up to the difference. And it would also exclude persons whose household assets exceed a certain level yet to be determined. And this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So these blank spaces in the bill have to be considered later. Claims for the prior year submitted on or before July 1 will be paid by the Department of Revenue by November 15th of the year in which the claims are filed, and it authorizes the Department of Revenue to adopt rules, prescribe forms, and examine applications in order to determine eligibility for the program. The language fits fairly closely with the current language for the elderly. Funding in the amount not to be specified yet, and this is the key, because my revenue estimates assume the maximum of the $1,500. But again, this is an important clause because it says that the funding in the amount of X dollars each year will be appropriated by the Legislative Assembly for the biennium beginning July 2005. The funding will be transferred into a suspense account from which the department will draw in order to administer the program. On or before November 1st of each biennium, the department shall determine how much money is needed to make payments to the claimants. If the appropriated amount is less than the total amount claimed or estimated by the department shall proportionately reduce the payment, so that the state will not accrue a debt in excess of the amount of the appropriation. The claim for payment cannot accrue. So in one year, if I'm a renter who claims the maximum or would be entitled to the maximum, but the appropriation isn't sufficient for the department to give me that, it would proportionately reduce the payment, and I would not be able to lay claim to that additional amount, carry forward, so to speak. If the appropriated amount is more than the total amount claimed, the excess amount will be available for payments in the second fiscal year of the biennium. All
right. Thank you. Yeah. Representatives Farr and Hunt, thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate you coming forward. We know that you're taking time away from your busy schedule. We're honored by your presence here today and would look forward to your testimony. Please enter and do so.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm State Representative in House District 14. And because we have a number of people that want to testify, I'm going to make my comments extremely brief. The reason that I co-sponsored this bill is that there is a high number of my constituents that live at or below the poverty level. One out of three families in Lane County, which I represent, have accessed a food box within the last year, and many of those same families who experience food insecurity also experience housing insecurity. And I want to illustrate that with a story. A few years back, I worked at Fairfield Elementary School, very high rate of poverty in my district. And I actually mentored a student in a class, and it was a member of his class, another student. And the assignment was to draw a picture of a house and that had all of the amenities that you would like, your dream house, if you will. And, you know, of course, so there were children that drew houses with swimming pools and spas. And this child just drew a picture of a house with three rooms and said that what he really hoped for was a place where he and his sister could have their own room and his mother could have her own space because his father had left the family and they were living on very little. At that time, they were in emergency housing. And then later, they had no housing because of the demands placed on their family financially. They essentially were homeless. But I think that for those of us in this room who probably live quite well and take our home and the amenities that home has for granted, I think it's extremely important to remember that there are many others who would be very happy with just four walls and a roof. Thank you for accepting my testimony.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Representative Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. And I do appreciate the opportunity of you convening this hearing today on House Bill 3110. It really, as you look at this bill, I think it's important to look at this bill not as the solution to the challenges that we face in terms of hunger and poverty in Oregon, but one critical piece of the solution. If you look at the statistics, Oregon continues to rank among the nation's hungriest states, and a lot of us don't feel like that should be true. If we were going to name the hungriest states, we'd probably name states in a certain part of the country that is not anywhere near us. And yet the facts just are there consistently that we're one of the hungriest states. I represent a completely suburban district. None of the city of Portland, areas that you would think would naturally be those where people are really suffering from hunger and poverty. And yet the issues around hunger and challenges around the percentage of rent that people have to pay out of their meager income are just astounding, even in my district. Unfortunately, today in Oregon, work is not a guarantee against hunger. Working Oregonians in two-income households even have a hunger rate almost four times higher than their counterparts in other states. Four times higher hunger rate in Oregon than those in the rest of the nation. And two-parent households with children have hunger rates more than three times the national average. Clearly, we've got a huge problem, and it's not just going to be solved by getting more food pantries, by getting more food banks. That's a piece of the problem. But looking at issues around the cost of housing and especially the cost of rent is critical. That's why Representative Farr and I have joined with a group of bipartisan legislators to bring House Bill 3110 to you. It also, this bill doesn't try something completely new. As your legislative revenue staff has indicated, it really takes an existing program that is very successful for the elderly and expands that across the spectrum to low-income Oregonians. This kind of approach has already been tried in 26 states today and the District of Columbia, who already have tax relief programs to help those who are struggling with the cost of housing. But let me just give you an example, because this really struck me since I have a household of four. But to take a family of four who makes $19,000 a year, that's slightly below 100% of the federal poverty level. So they live modestly. every month, let's say they pay $550 in rent for a two-bedroom and one-bath apartment. Again, that's a family of four in a two-bedroom apartment. I don't know about you, but my family of four lives in a four-bedroom house. This hypothetical family, which is not so hypothetical, pays utilities. Their monthly gas, electric, and water bills average about $75 a month. So that means their annual gross rent, the actual rent plus utilities, is $7,500 a year. Again, their annual gross income, $19,000. Their annual gross rent and utilities, $7,500. This 30% limit that this bill would impose would say that they only have to pay $5,700. And for the rest of that, they would get a tax credit, that $1,800 difference. Think about what $1,800 would mean to that family that's just making $19,000 a year. They are not the poorest of the poor, so they don't qualify for a lot of the programs that we as a state or the federal government provides. They miss out on a lot of those because they have jobs and they're working. And yet today they don't get any assistance to restrict the amount of their income that they can pay in rent. And $550 is not a high level of rent in my district, and I suspect it is not in many of yours. So we think, Representative Farr and I think this is an important piece of addressing the issue of issues around hunger and poverty in Oregon. We can and should do something like this to help families in our state. And I want to thank you again for hearing House Bill 3110 today, and Representative Farr and I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representatives Hunt or Farr? Thank you again. You've honored us by coming and taking time from your busy schedule. And we do appreciate you bringing this testimony and this bill before us. Thank you again. We've got quite a number of folks signed up for our presentation today, and if I could bring you up in groups of the way that you've signed up, more or less, Mark Nelson, Oregon Housing Alliance, Michael Anderson, Oregon Housing Alliance, Ellen Lowell from the Oregon Food Bank. Now, Ellen, you'll have other folks that will be coming up from the Oregon Food Bank, and if you don't want to associate with these two rascals, I'd say that's fine too. But. Mark, why don't you go ahead and lead off if you want to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Housing Alliance. We are here today, and we will be providing several panels for you to support House Bill 3110. Members of the Housing Alliance believe that hardworking people in Oregon should be able to afford housing and still have the money left for food and basic necessities. We understand the predicament that this committee is in, as well as other places in the building. Every day we're either in Ways and Means, we're looking for money, or we're in revenue committees talking about tax credits and talking about ways to generate additional dollars. So I understand that the fiscal is around $14 million, and we understand that that is a sizable amount, especially as you are working very hard to come to agreement between the Senate and the House as it relates to that overall budget, and I know today how difficult that is. But we would like you today to listen to the members of the various panels, because I think they bring a very distinct local perspective to this issue that I think is dramatically important to everyone in Oregon, and in particular one out of every four people in Oregon who can't afford the cost of housing in this state. So we'd like to start with Ellen Lowe, representing the Oregon Food Bank, and then Michael Anderson, who is with the Community Development Network. Ellen.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, a legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and we do indeed belong to the Housing Alliance, so I do associate with these folks. Some of you know that I spend most of my time at the other end of this hall in hearing room F, and I would suggest that I would need to spend less time there if indeed we did do some things within our tax code like 3110. I do appear today on behalf of the Oregon Food Bank to seek your endorsement of 3110. The food bank has its mission to eliminate hunger and its root causes, because no one should be hungry. you are going to find in the packets that have been distributed to you numbers about the extent of our service across the entire state, our working with regional food banks, with local pantries, with soup kitchens, and the fact that we distributed over 59 million pounds of food last year. And perhaps that should be viewed as a measure of success, but really the outcome measurement that the Oregon Food Bank seeks is that no one should be hungry, that we should only have to exist in order to respond to emergencies. We are increasingly hearing at soup kitchens, at the food pantries, our stories about the increased costs for health services and for housing that are causing people to have to come for additional help. We do surveys, and the last one we did with over 3,700 Oregonians, we find that 25% spent 75% or more on housing. Now 50%, 51% actually spent 50% or more of their income on housing. And so these are folks who are in need because of what's been happening to our economy here in Oregon. The TANF program, or I guess I should use temporary assistance for needy families, that only goes up to 48% of the federal poverty level. And I have included in your packets both the 2004 and the 2005 federal poverty level. And so there's very little help for those who are above that 48%. The Oregon Health Plan standard was supposed to have served this population. It's a shell of what it was meant to be. I recall that during the 2003 session, when this committee did some work on possible ways of reforming our tax system, and you used the tax incident model, one of the things that you discovered was that in terms of being fair to all Oregonians related to housing, that you really needed to do something in terms of a tax credit or some way of adjusting the tax code to accommodate their need. And when you did this, it also became very apparent that the current system was very unfair to those who rent in terms of how it treats housing. And so 3110 really is an effort to seek some additional fairness. You're going to hear from people who will be talking about the importance of being able to stay in their housing, because it makes a difference in terms of schools, congregations, jobs, transportation. It's stability. And that same kind of stability for that family then translates into stability for a community as well. I have attached to my testimony HJR 65, which was passed in the 2001 session. And I commend it to you because it talks about a 10-year goal. Remember, that was 2001. And so if you look at the second page and you see those things that need to happen, you will note that rental assistance is one of those. I think all of HJR 65 really provides a roadmap. And we encourage you to embark on that so that the public responsibility can be assumed by this legislature, because you're going to hear from those in the private sector and the not-for-profit sector who have been your willing partners, but they need your help. And so do those Oregonians who are renters. And I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Michael Anderson, and I'm part of the Statewide Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is comprised of local city and county governments, financial institutions, nonprofit housing developers, housing authorities, housing and renter advocacy organizations, and civic groups like the League of Women Voters, 1,000 Friends, and our friends at the Oregon Food Bank. We at the Housing Alliance believe that hardworking people should be able to afford housing and still have money left over for groceries and other basic necessities. We believe that seniors and people with disabilities ought to be able to live with independence and dignity that comes with safe, stable, affordable housing. We believe that with housing comes the opportunity to build better lives. Unfortunately, for many Oregonians, access to that opportunity that comes with housing is nearly impossible. For over the past decade and a half, the rising cost of housing in our state has far outpaced our wages. National figures indicate that one in four Oregonians, both homeowners and renters, are living in housing that they can't afford. And they determine that, they say, when you pay over 30% of your income for housing, that becomes housing you can't afford. Now, when we focus just on renters, the picture gets more dire. One in four households that's renting in Oregon is paying more than half their income for rent, so far above that 30% threshold. Unfortunately, that gives us a rank of 49th of 50 in the United States of America in terms of rental affordability. Now, when you focus on an even narrower band, the people who would be impacted and helped by HB 3110, we find that 6 out of 10 of the lowest income households are paying more than half their income to rent. This compares to about 4 in 10 nationally. So again, here in Oregon, we need to figure out to do something so we can get on par with the rest of the states in providing for the needs of our hardworking families, our seniors, and our people with disabilities. We know that excessive rent burdens destabilize families. We know that it negatively impacts a child's school performance. We know that it undermines the ability of seniors and people with disabilities to live independently and maintain that dignity that comes with independent living. In the worst case, we know that people who do not have the support they need in their housing can fall all the way through the cracks, perhaps even to homelessness. We must take some significant steps towards meeting the housing needs in the state of Oregon. The Housing Alliance has developed a 4-point housing opportunity agenda in which we propose legislation that will directly impact those Oregonians most affected by the shortage of housing that is affordable to those on limited incomes. Today we come before you to discuss the low-income renters tax program. We believe that this low-income renters program will be a success because it's modeled after a successful program, the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. This would be open to all Oregonians who are living below this federal poverty level, which, as Representative Hunt pointed out, is very low. It's hard to imagine, in fact, how you get by day to day at that low. And we know that this would be something that would be directed towards people who are above that threshold of 30% of their renter income. In other words, this bill would give tax relief to the lowest income renters who need that relief most. This would put money right back into the pockets of hardworking families, right back into the pockets of seniors, right back in the pockets of people with disabilities, so they would not be forced to make that horrible choice that comes, should I pay my rent or should I buy my groceries? Members of the Revenue Committee, the Low-Income Renters Program is a great idea that will make an immediate impact on the lives of Oregonians. Housing gives people an opportunity to build better lives. If we want to see a real economic recovery for all Oregonians, people need a place to go home, to call home, and this bill will help them have that place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Questions of this portion of the group today, this panel? Again, thank you very much. Thank you, Barbara, for coming today. Let's see, Clyde Docker, City Club of Portland, John Blatt, Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations, and Tina Kotek again. Children First for Oregon. Clyde, why don't you go ahead and start, please?
Thank you. My name is Clyde Doctor, and I appear before you today to testify in favor of House Bill 3110 on behalf of the City Club of Portland. And the City Club, I should point out, is also a member of the Housing Alliance. The City Club's positions on affordable housing issues are spelled out in its report, Affordable Housing in Portland, which was adopted by its members on February 8, 2002. The report is extensive, so I'll summarize briefly and leave a full copy of the report for your records. In brief, our chief conclusion is that the affordable housing support system is ineffective because it is significantly underfunded. We found that both the federal and Oregon state governments have adopted goals to provide decent and adequate housing for low-income households. Yet our analysis shows that over the 65 years since public housing legislation was adopted by Congress, neither Congress, the legislature, nor local governments combined have provided annually and on average more than about one-third of the funding needed to meet that worthy goal. The interesting thing about that analysis is how consistent it was over the 65 years with all the changes in administration, all the economic changes that have occurred in the country. The funding for low-income programs is usually just about a third of the need, varying only a few percent. Most of the lowest-income households, including many of the working poor, are renters who must compete in a lottery for scarce rent subsidies. Presently, less than one-third of low-income renters who are eligible for increasingly rare rental subsidies have any hope of winning one. Now, others today will speak of the drastic cuts in Section 8 funding that are turning the unaffordable housing problem into a full-blown crisis. Given the large unmet need for funding and declining resources, HB 3110 can be not just well-timed relief, but a real lifesaver for low-income working families who are struggling to stay afloat in a cross-current of declining wages, funding cuts, and soaring housing costs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Blatt. I am with the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. We are a group of about 100 organizations around the state that develop and own or participate in the development and owning of affordable housing. We own about 10,000 units that have been built since 1990, and we house a little over 25,000 people every night. We're here in support of this bill because we think it's something that is very needed. The kind of development that we do has a very difficult time hitting people at this level of income. We cannot really provide them with affordable rents. And adding this tax credit on top of what we're able to do and what the market is able to do will just provide a lot more affordable housing. Representative Hunt talked a little bit about the numbers behind what it's like to live at this level. If you had been on the Senate Revenue Committee last week, we had a tenant of one of our developments here. Her name was Jamie Bishop. She's a mother of three, a single mom, and she lives in Lebanon at Carolina Court. A year ago, she got off of TANF, got a job paying about $1,400 a month. Out of that $1,400, she pays $800 to child care. And she lives on the rest. She's living on a very low income. Her annual income is about $16,000 for a family of four, so she would qualify for this program. Being able to live in one of our projects, being able to have some child care help and food stamps, she's actually saving money and talked to the committee about the fact that she wants to own a home, and she can actually see that in her future. And if we can add a tax credit like this on top of that, we can make home ownership happen for someone like Jamie. And I'll conclude my testimony there.
Thank you.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, nice to see you again. Again, my name is Tina Kotek. I'm the policy director with Children First for Oregon. Thank you for allowing us to testify today on this bill. Children First is a nonprofit organization, and we focus on a variety of issues affecting the well-being of children, and one of them is the financial stability of families. We know that there are far too many children in the state who live in households that are not financially stable. And so we work on issues like child care and health care, and housing is another cost that many families can just not meet. And our goal is to provide the most stable households we can for kids so they can do well in school, succeed, to go up up to be successful adults. We support 3110 because it's a cost-effective way of providing some assistance to working families through the tax system, creates some fairness in terms of making sure working families are not overburdened with their rental costs. We want to make sure, that, again, that our children live in stable households, and housing costs, as they go up, create a lot of instability for families. We know that low-income families are twice as likely to move to find cheaper housing. It's a forced instability when your housing is too expensive and or safe, or unsafe in many cases. Not always expensive, but it's unsafe. Families are forced to move. What can we do as a state to reduce that instability for families? And 3110 would help in that regard. And we like to think that families are moving in to buy homes, but renters move from one rental household to another. And so this kind of credit would allow families to do some planning, that not have to move as often, and we think that is a very good idea for children in the state. One statistic I like to remind people about is that 37% of children in the state of Oregon, more than one in three children, live in low-income households. They are living in food insecure households where their parents don't know how to provide the next meal. They're living in households where they're one rent check away from losing their housing. So it's really ought to be a priority for the state to do what we can to make sure those families can stay stable, because that's in the best interest of the child. And we think 3110 is a great idea in terms of its cost effectiveness through the tax system, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. We appreciate your coming. Questions for Clyde or John or Tina? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was pointed out to me, and then I heard it several times, that this keeps being referred to as a tax credit, and it really isn't a tax credit, is it? This is for staff.
No, it's a program where the Department of Revenue would pay out of a fund that's appropriated.
So it's a grant.
Right. A subsidy.
It is indeed a subsidy, and the department would be authorized to adopt rules, prescribe forms, and examine the applications in order to determine the eligibility of the program, and then pay out at some point after July 1st, but before November 15th of the year subsequent. So for those folks who have paid that as early as January of year one, won't see dollar one coming back to them until sometime after July and before November of year two. So other questions of Clyde or John or Tina? Thank you very much for
coming.
Thank you. Appreciate your participation here. Julie Massa, Shanna Pastor, and I'm sorry, Pastorius, and Philip Kennedy Wong, Ecumenical Ministries. Julie Massa, Shanna Pastorius, and Philip Kennedy Wong. Thank you. Please.
Chair Butler and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Julie Massa, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank. I reside in the city of Beaverton in a rented apartment on Shoals Ferry Road in Representative Galizia's district. I have lived in the same apartment for 4 years. In the last 2.5 years that I've volunteered and worked with Oregon Food Bank, I've had the opportunity to take glimpses into the lives of many people who turn to our Oregon Food Bank network seeking emergency food assistance. I have a great deal of contact with hardworking people who are faced with the daily struggle of meeting their most basic needs within their extremely limited family budgets. I'd like you to turn your attention to the gray packets that Ellen Lowe distributed to you. In the packet, you'll see a sheet of statistics labeled the State of Hunger. On the back side, there's a left-hand section entitled Housing Costs Eat Up Food Budgets. These statistics are the results of our 2004 Hunger Factor Survey performed in April of 2004. The survey was distributed to nearly all emergency food box recipients in nearly 100 emergency food box agencies throughout Oregon. And the staggering results are as follows. As was mentioned earlier, 51% of the respondent households spent more than 50% of their income on rent. Only 13% own their home, and 8% own a mobile home. 46% of the respondent households do rent. 10% were homeless, and 25% had to move in the past 2 years to find affordable housing. As mentioned before, the Department of Housing and Urban Development characterizes affordable housing as rent or mortgage payments that consume no more than 30% of a family's income. Therefore, the wage needed in Oregon to reach housing affordability would be $13.59 per hour. In Multnomah County, it would be nearly $15.29 per hour. At our 2005 minimum wage level, it would be, $7.25 per hour. A person would need to work nearly 75 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom unit at fair market rent. In the packets, you will also find the 2003-2005 summaries of our annual focus group reports entitled Voices. We traveled the state of Oregon speaking to low-income people about their struggles. Again, a common thread is the difficulty these hardworking people have paying rent and providing affordable, nutritious food for their families. I have met people who are literally choosing between quality food and rent. As recent as Friday morning, I spoke with a mother of two who lives in Woodburn. The mother, who is bound and determined to make it without the help of welfare program, started a service industry job 2 weeks ago. As is customary, the employer has held her paycheck for 2 weeks, and her rent payment was due Friday. Terrified that she'd be late with rent, lose her apartment, and be homeless, she called me in tears and asked me to direct her to an emergency food box agency in her area. She was telling me she would not be able to pay rent and buy groceries. I sit here today and recall the pain and terror in her voice. I envision the tears rolling down her cheeks, and I can assure you that I have received hundreds of similar phone calls in the last 2 years. I ask you to consider a renter's tax credit, and although it may not provide immediate relief to the woman in Woodburn, any relief that we provide around housing to people who are struggling is absolutely necessary. We've seen low-income people use refundable credits, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, as a down payment on a home, which would be an economic stimulus to any community. House Bill 3110 is the gateway for these opportunities for low-income people. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Chairman Pastorius.
Chair Butler and committee members, my name is Hannah Pastorius, and I live in Beaverton. I have multiple sclerosis and am living on Social Security disability income. I pay approximately 72% of my income on rent. Once I pay for rent, electric, and phone, I have little money left for food, clothing, and medical expenses. I am $172 over the annual income limit of the $9,500 a year figure, and I'm still far below the poverty level. Any type of rebate would be a tremendous help in meeting my day-to-day simple needs. In addition to my food, rent, phone, electricity, I need money for medications that are not covered by the patient assistance programs. I need food. I need clothes. I need household cleaning items. I need personal care items, and I like to buy a CD now and again. Approval of this bill would not only help me, but would be a great help to low-income parents. Having been a single divorced mother, I know firsthand about the hand-to-mouth experience these parents experience. They worry about having enough money to purchase clothes and shoes for rapidly growing children. They worry about having enough money to feed the bottomless pit stomachs that these children seem to have. The need for having enough money to cover food, clothing, and medical and prescription drug costs so the children can stay healthy and grow strong and grow into strong, happy adults can only be a valuable asset to our society, and the benefit is unquestionable. I ask you to consider House Bill 3110, not only for myself, but for the children who, no fault of their own, need a helping hand. And I thank you for hearing my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. It's a pleasure to have you here today. How much did you say your rent was in relationship with 70-something percent?
72%.
And how much is the total rent?
My rent is $585 a month. My income is
$806. Okay. And the $585, does it include utilities?
No, that is separate.
In addition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please, Philip.
Chair Butler, Vice Chair Haas, and Vice Chair Representative Berger. For the record, my name is Philip Kennedy Wong, representing EMO, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are the State Association of Churches. I want to thank the committee for this opportunity to testify, but also point out Representatives Comp and Olson for also adding your names as co-sponsors to this legislation. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon supports HB 3110. The cost of housing, as you know, has been rising at a rate faster than wages in Oregon, and as a result, rent is taking more of the household income of many Oregonians, especially those living on the margins. This means there is less household income available for other important needs like food. One indicator has been the exploding number of Oregonians eligible for food stamps, approximately 800,000 statewide. We believe that all people should be afforded life's basic necessities. No one should go hungry or without clothing, shelter, or health care. This belief is shared among all of our member denominations. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to cite a passage from the Book of Acts that sort of exemplifies this core belief. This is from the Book of Acts, chapter 4, verses 33 to 35. This is when Peter and John are being released from the high priest after being questioned. God greatly blessed his followers, and no one went in need of anything. Everyone who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles. Then they would give the money to anyone who needed it. Rents have increased in part by landlords passing on property taxes to their renters. And unlike homeowners, renters can't deduct their rent, meaning like homeowners get to deduct their property taxes and also their mortgages, mortgage interest. Property taxes are the most progressive form of taxation. According to the Oregon Tax Incidence Model, which you have before you, it's behind the copy of my testimony, property tax encompasses the largest share of the tax burden for low-income Oregonians. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development estimates that no household should pay more than 30% of its income to housing. In Oregon, we have roughly 46% of renters and 25% of homeowners that pay more than 30%, and this is an actual increase overall in the last 10-plus years. And if you look, as part of my testimony, I've included charts on a county-by-county basis that analyzes the county level of people who are paying more than 30% of their income and also the number of people by county who are living at poverty level. Oregon has a population of close to 400,000 people living at or below the federal poverty level, and this is far too many people at risk of poverty and simply unacceptable. We have the chance to do something to change this situation. It is imperative that we take advantage of this opportunity. We believe that House Bill 3110 is probably the single most effective way of reducing the tax burden on low-income Oregonians. HB 3110 would provide families up to $1,500 a year if they qualify. And this money would go towards purchasing some of the basic necessities that many of us take for granted, and it would go straight into the economy. There is a bill, HB 2914, in the House Committee on Veteran Affairs, which would create a similar program just for National Guard members and members of the reserves. This is a reminder that many veterans and reservists are living close to the poverty line. They, too, experience a rising cost of housing, taking a bigger bite of their household. And unfortunately, they are no different than the other Oregonians at risk. And I can share my personal experience as someone who served 6 years in the Marine Corps Reserves and having to rely on other sources of income to put me through college and obviously meet my housing needs. House Bill 3110 is a pro-family bill. We ask that you pass HB 3110 to relieve the tax burden and the high cost of housing for Oregon's poorest residents. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Philip. Are there questions of this particular group? Thank you again for your testimony. We appreciate you being here today. And the final group that we have to answer all of the questions then are Paul Rainey and Patty Whitney Wise. Patty, I'm told that you do bring all of the answers with you. So better bring a suitcase up there if you want. Uh, Why don't you lead off, please?
Thank you, Chair Butler. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the Director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. Most of what I had planned to share with you today has already been shared by other members, so I will not be repeating that. But two things I would like to reiterate. One has to do with the poverty level itself. The poverty level was created based on a family's needs in the late 1950s, at which time a family spent about a third of their income on food, a third of their income on housing, and a third of their income on everything else, thereby the sort of third for housing that you hear about quite a bit, 30%, 33%. Times have changed considerably, and just in light of the two bills you heard earlier today, there was no child care figured into the poverty level. They expected one parent to stay home with the kids. So any family who is working and having child care costs automatically are lower than the poverty level, even though they may look like they have higher than poverty level wages because of that increased cost for them. You heard many people testify about how many families are paying more than 30% of their income on housing. And this is one of the reasons why in our Act to End Hunger, we cite housing subsidies as being one area that is of much need, and the renter's tax credit is one of those pieces that we would support, because clearly that money then would be freed up from housing for other basic needs like food, which is one of the biggest areas we see lacking because people are paying so much for their housing. Also, just a quick comment on the family mentioned where they may be able to save up enough to get into a home of their own, and especially if they have a tax credit like this. When you're a homeowner, you do get quite a bit of relief, tax relief, by being able to deduct the interest on your mortgage. That's something that's not available to renters, and this is one way of helping provide some equity as well between renters and homeowners. We're very much in support of this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And Paul?
One more slide. Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Paul Rainey. I am here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. Since 1938, we have been accountable to Oregon's housing needs and currently provide stable housing for over 45,000 households here in Oregon. Simply put, we meet the housing needs not met by the private marketplace. Every year, we contribute millions of dollars in Section 8 housing choice vouchers to local communities. This is federal funding that goes directly to help low-income families that are struggling to make ends meet here in Oregon. This last year, we've seen a decline in federal commitment to the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. In Oregon, we're currently faced with a shortfall of approximately $11 million in federal housing assistance due to the recent cuts. As a result, we have seen the following impacts on our communities and low-income children, seniors, and families that are an integral part of our neighborhoods. It is estimated that 905 families will lose housing assistance. Numerous households, in addition, will receive reduced housing assistance payments, which will increase their rents, placing the burden on them. And finally, the shortfall will increase the wait for the 42,100 Oregonians that are currently on our waiting list to receive rental assistance. The bottom line is we're being asked to do more with less. The result is devastating for many low-income families throughout Oregon. Unable to keep pace with skyrocketing housing costs, hardworking families are being forced to make tough decisions. These are decisions that none of us would like to make. To name a few, families must choose between housing and food, health care, the increasing cost of utilities, or prescription drugs. With the recent shortfalls to the federal level to affordable housing, the burden is being shifted from the national level to the state and local communities. That is why we're here today. To help fill the void, we need your help. And that's why we ask for your support on House Bill 3110 and other innovative solutions such as the low-income tax renters program, which are essential to meeting the affordable housing need. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, did you differentiate your testimony relative to those of age 58 and older who are presently under the system of one kind or another?
In terms of the reductions to those, we haven't sorted them out. We have just kind of an overall. In terms of where the cuts are going to place, it's kind of hard to say.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We also have Sabina Rigg. If you'd like to come forward, Sabina, you folks can stay there if you'd like. This is the last person to have signed up. I do have some questions specifically for Patty as well. So, Sabina?
Good afternoon. Members of the panel. My name is Sabina Riggi. I'm an advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, as well as I'm one of those people that Representative Hunt was talking about. I kind of call it the gray area. I have made it kind of my passion to help people get affordable housing, help them get self-sufficient, with the understanding that it's a long process and there's a lot of things that have been going on in the state of Oregon that has made this happen. With 3110, I do believe that it would be kind of a relief, but at the same time, you're dealing with a lot of families that are not only dealing with their children, but they're dealing with their grandchildren. With the epidemics that we have in the state right now, we're dealing with a lot of malnutrition. You're thinking of children going to school, and because we can only afford to pay the rent, that may be the only meal that they get. Can you imagine a grandchild or one of your children not being able to get the nutrition? We're looking at obesity. A lot of obesity is from not eating nutritious food. So, again, I hope and urge that 3110 you do take into consideration.
Thank you, Sabina. Questions of Patty or Paul or Sabina? Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm usually relatively quiet, but I want to vent a little bit.
Please, Representative. Would you like me to yield the gavel to you while you vent?
I listened to the federal budget being cut and everything passed down to the states in this regard. And while we're giving huge tax cuts and cutting off these very folks that need this, and I'm livid. I just beside myself that this is happening to people, and I think this is a good thing that we are proposing to do. I don't believe that we should have to make up the shortfall from our federal government who's handing out money to other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Riley. I wonder if you could maybe teach my wife to be livid at that level.
Although I did see your hair stand up a little.
Patty, I have a number of questions, and I'm going to involve a couple of other folks in the room with regard to these questions. Just questions that I've jotted down as I've heard some of the testimony, and I'm anxious about these kinds of things. Now, I understand that we've got Bob Castagna here as well from the Oregon Catholic Conference, but I'm going to ask some questions that I'm anxious to know the answer to as to the administration of this program. And Representative Hunt is still here, so then he may have contemplated much of this. I'm interested as to how we would address this issue with regard to students, and particularly those folks that might have dorms or student rates, where you mingle a group of students to share rentals, and how that would be administered. And I I'm trying to think back as to how we administered the old HARP program, the Homeowner and Assistant Rental Program.
Yes, that would probably give us some clues on how it could be done. I wasn't living in the state at that time, although I grew up here. I was away for a while.
You'd have been just a tiny girl anyway.
I hate to tell you not. However, we'll look into the student situation. Obviously, if they're in a dormitory, I think this probably would not apply.
Same issue with singles, Patty.
Mom
and dad just get tired of daughter, and daughter has a boyfriend, and they're just going to share rent. My concern is that that brings up another complete issue, and that is, what if family gifts for the payment of rents for those students and others? I recognize that the department has some latitude as to the rulemaking. Administration costs by the Department of Revenue. I'd like to go back and have the department dredge up how much the administration costs were for the original HARP programs and how much it's presently allocating to administer the age 58 program with 20%. And Patty, you brought up a point relative to the traditional amounts, the old 30% rule.
Yes.
And I think Representative Esquivel, in the real estate background that he may have, could address that, but I'm anxious as to how we came up with the 30% here, because the rules that we had were 33% to 35%. Relative to that, the question that I have would also be, what of other accoutrements that might be provided in the rental? What of utilities which could be included in rent? One place would have utilities, another not. So if I pay out an extra $150 for my housing unit because it's got all utilities included,
right,
would I then be entitled to something more, whereas the person who is having to pick up her own utilities, his or her own utilities, then would not be equally as benefited?
Okay.
I'm interested, again, this goes back to the HARP program. I know that those that can't play in this, from this information we've got here, includes the elderly who are on assistance or through the Department of Human Services, but what of senior centers, particularly where they're using their household assets to finalize any of those kinds of payments, or using their insurance payments? Because we do have now, since the old HARP program, we do have actually senior insurance programs that will pay for a portion of those utilities, or of those utilities. Of that.
Seniors are already under the 58 and older, so they would not be affected by this new program.
Okay.
So that piece, I think, would be taken care of.
So the elderly would be pitched out, but what of the...
This is actually a program that mirrors the elderly assistance program. It's already in existence, so they're not kicked out. They're already getting some benefit, and this just expands it to those younger than 58.
And so if I have someone with 55 that's had a stroke and has the insurance,
so then you're,
to pick up that
product. So there are people, is what you're saying.
There would be folks that would have some other resources, and I'm just anxious about that.
Okay.
What of would this bill, and this is part of a larger question, the household assets is an important item here, and I realize that's a blank.
Person
whose household assets exceed X dollars.
We did talk about that last Friday as we were planning for the hearing, and thought that we could put in the same amount as in the elderly assistance program, which is the $25,000 limit on assets.
All right. So then my question becomes, would this be an occasion for those divorces, which would be occasion to reduce household assets, so that a spouse would be enticed to divorce another spouse in order to limit those household assets?
I would say that one thing that wasn't brought up during the testimony today is that there is a limit on this of $1,500 a year. I would guess that's probably low enough to not cause intentional divorces. It's
okay.
Not a lot of money.
Okay. The next question I would have would this assistance be taxable? I think Philip kind of touched base on on some of the in his testimony, and that gave me rise to wonder if this wouldn't create another asset, which would be a taxable asset under Oregon's current rather aggressive tax scheme for those that are earning very small amounts. Mm-hmm.
And our intention would be to match it to what exists now for the elderly assistance. Okay. I'll get the answer to that for you. Yeah.
Let's see. What of non-taxable, i.e. insurance or structured settlement awards, as to income? So again, we've got a structured settlement or some other structured settlement or some other payment, and I referred to that just a moment ago as to an insurance award. So I've got a child, age 20, age 15, age 13, in a facility that is receiving an insurance award to pay for that a portion of that, who has other income but would be ascribing some portion of that income towards the cost of that facility.
Okay.
We talked about gifts to family members. What if someone else pays the rents for students or others? And those are, I think those are, that's basically the, I would like to come back and just take a look at some of the historic and how the present senior program works with that 20%. Why this is 30% versus the 20% that we do for seniors.
In terms of the housing costs?
In terms of the housing.
Yeah, and that 30% is the standard nationally for how much a person should be paying of their income towards rent. So anything above that is going to put a strain on their providing their other basic needs.
And so for seniors age 58 and older, we say it's over 20%. Is that right?
They're fortunate. I have to go back and double check on that for you.
It's about the class warfare that we're talking about here, of having certain people at one level and certain people at another.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yes, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think those are excellent questions. They really are, especially with the dorm situation, with a son or daughter still is living at home and doesn't pay rent, but yet may fall into this category. And I think those kind of questions may argue for maybe a different avenue, like the refundability of their earned income tax credit, which I know you support, Pat.
Yes.
Or what I've been looking at for a long time is just to shift our income tax rate so you don't pay income, say, in the first $20,000 or whatever it is. And perhaps that's a cleaner way to get help to this same group than the difficulty.
That's an excellent point, Representative Hass, and I know we talked about that as a method whereby you could do some of this shifting. That brings up the other issue, and that is, what are the parents that charge rent to the kids? Mm-hmm. Then you have the household income issue, but what if they live in the garage, above the garage? So I'm concerned about all of those kinds of administrative kinds of questions that we'll put ourselves into in that regard.
Right. I think probably looking back at the HARP program will help us a great deal with those questions, and then I'll take a little closer look at the elderly rental assistance to answer some of the other questions that
when
you have.
When you think you've got all of the questions answered, then you go back and put it into play, and then all of a sudden you'll see how many really inventive Oregonians we have that will come up with the answers that we didn't ever contemplate the questions to. Other questions for this particular panel? Bob Castagna has signed up, subsequent, and I'll add him here. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for coming. I appreciate your...
I'll try to get those answers to you as soon as possible.
Thank you, Patty, for going through the drill with me there. And Bob, you're signed up... going to make a special exception for Bob to stand here. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference represents the Catholic bishops of Oregon on issues of public policy in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 people in pursuit of the common good. The Oregon Catholic Conference today would like to go on record in support of House Bill 3110. As the members realize, the Oregon Catholic Conference testified earlier this session in support of House Bill 2046, the refundable earned income credit, and we join our support for that bill with House Bill 3110. I just would like to ask the committee members to keep in mind a moral principle from Catholic social teaching, and that moral principle is the preferential option for the poor, so that as this committee and the legislature deliberates on either tax credit proposals or tax reduction proposals this session, which would impact the general funds available for programs in the state of Oregon, we would ask you to keep that principle in mind, a preferential option for the poor. You have many proposals before you, many which would reduce revenues for the state of Oregon. But from our moral teaching, we believe that if you start off asking the question, what does this proposal do to the poor, for the poor, and how do the poor participate in it, you will reach and arrive at a just decision. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Castagna? Thank you very much, Bob. We appreciate you coming forward. Colleagues, this that concludes the questions or the panels on rental assistance. Representative Hass, help me. We've had an earned income credit, a refundable EIC, and this one, and there's one other that has come forward. I'm trying to remember what it is for the specifically low income. Would you work with two members of our committee? I'm looking down at Representative Galizio. He's trying to read something in the palm of his hand.
No, I was trying to remember what the other
Representative Olson. Would you form a small subcommittee and take this rental assistance bill, the earned income, the refundable earned income credit, and any others that we've heard of or heard or that might be in the mill, and let's bring the best of those forward as to what you feel like that we might be able to reasonably come forward with, and then bring that back to the committee. Let's say within 10 days, and see if we can't pass something out here that would be a meaningful opportunity, and then that'll give us an opportunity to take back a look, and Patty can help us with the questions that we've got, and the Department of Revenue and others. And there'll be a resource for you. So if Deborah, if you and Patty and Ellen, others that have, and Representatives Hunt and Farr certainly have an oar in this water, but if you three would form a subcommittee to bring us back what you feel of this of these proposals that we've looked at that might be able to really provide some meaningful relief for this particular sector. I think it's appropriate that we continue to pursue this. The concern I've had here, you've heard my question, is that there's some administration issues and some cost factors from the Department of Revenue that we'll want to get. Again, Deborah would be able to provide you some assistance there through the old HARP program, and Patty and Alan and others. So with that, we'll form an informal ad hoc subcommittee on 3110 and other related issues, and the list that we've heard today is certainly an excellent resource. Further questions relative to the items that we've discussed today? Again, I appreciate your participation, and colleagues, again, we're going to take Wednesday to 4 o'clock if we can. We do have an agenda that day that we could be done with before 4 o'clock. I just want to try and encourage us to go ahead and begin the process of lengthening our stride and quickening our pace as we proceed forward. With that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on 3110 and close House Revenue for today. Thank you very much.